Welcome to the New Zealand Tech Podcast, presented by Paul Spain and guests.
Hello and welcome along to the New Zealand Tech Podcast, episode number 116. I'm Paul Spain.
I'm Sim Ahmed.
And I'm Bill Bennett.
Welcome along, guys. We've got quite a bit to chat about tonight. Now, first up, new gadget that's just arrived with us from Hewlett-Packard. This is their Elite Pad 900. Now, this is quite different to some of the other tablet products that we've seen from HP in the past that are traditionally more consumer-oriented, such as the Envy X2 that we looked at around the launch of Windows 8. This one's aimed at very much sort of enterprise and business space. And looks pretty cool. What did you think, Sim, on first handling it? I mean, the device is quite similar to an iPad, isn't it?
In terms of it's
got that 4x3 form factor and similar sort of size and look.
It's also got that same kind of feel. The back is aluminum, I think. It feels like it, at least. And it's about the same weight. And really, it looks like an iPad of sorts, just gone horizontal. I'm really curious about the slip-on attachments that you're showing me before. These it kind of turns it into a bit more rugged unit, but also adds connection ports like an SD card slot and HDMI, which kind of makes it like a little hot desking client device, which is pretty cool.
Yeah, well, it's got a full docking unit as well, which we've seen something similar from Samsung with their Series 5 tablet that came out with Windows 7. And was often one of the sort of the popular devices in the lead up to Windows 8, but yeah, that style of being able to dock it straight at your desk and have it link into one or two monitors and all your bits and pieces is really nice in the way that it operates.
I'm sorry, HP, but it's exactly what I was expecting to see from Lenovo. It didn't happen, but it is, isn't it? It's got that businessy, ThinkPad-y kind of feel to it.
Well, it's not sort of, I mean, there's the ThinkPad one coming through, or there's a couple. There's a ThinkPad Tablet 2 that we looked at last year, and there's the Helix coming through shortly as well. But, I mean, this one does look a very sort of iPad-ish, doesn't it, in terms of the...
It does. I was just comparing the two next to each other, and it's a little larger than the iPad by about, I don't know, probably about 10 mils in length. But it's, you're right, it feels the same, the weight and everything. It's really nice feeling. And
it's got a very good look to it. I know those are Lenovo pads. They kind of have that ruggedized business feel. This is nice, slim. I can kind of see myself carrying it around. It looks cool. I know it doesn't matter to a lot of people, but it is important sometimes just to have something that you have that's good.
Well, I think the thing that the way I would describe that, Sim, is that a lot of the non-Apple tablets are a bit toy-like, and this one is definitely not a toy. This is a tool.
What's the processing power on this spot?
So this is an Atom dual core 1.8 gigahertz CPU. So what that means is it's able to run the full professional version of Windows 8, but it doesn't have the same sort of power as some of those, you know, i5 and i7 devices that we've looked at. But it also means that this is a completely enclosed device. It doesn't have to have, you know, a whole lot of cooling and those sorts of things that the more powerful ones do. And for just everyday use of, you know, basic office apps and so on, I think a lot of people will find that this is quite a good go-to machine, and also that ability to have mobile capability. So this unit that we've got has got embedded 3G, so you can just put a micro SIM card in there. Also, in the same, when you open up the space to get at the SIM slot, there's also a memory card slot in there, a micro SD slot. So you get that extra benefit, which is quite handy, being able to, you know, bump up from the base 64 gigs worth of storage that's included.
And it looks like there's a couple of HP specific apps on here as well. I haven't had a chance to look at them yet.
Yeah, I mean, there's some. They always have some extra bits and pieces for keeping firmware and, you know, other bits and pieces, up to date. But yeah, I think overall, nice piece of hardware. The sleeves are really interesting to me as well. So I saw briefly one of the first sleeve units that I don't think is for sale here yet that actually incorporates a keyboard. and can also incorporate an extra battery. So, I mean, there's a lot more we could go into around it, but if you're interested in a tablet for business use, this is definitely one worth looking at online. There's a few pros and cons that really the only sort of major downside I saw people complaining about in reviews were that it wasn't the widescreen format that we've seen on other Windows tablet, which means you don't have that snap to feature with Windows 8 apps. But I think a lot of people actually still, you know, I've heard people complaining, oh, I don't like the widescreen tablet, I'd prefer one that's more 4x3 form factor like the iPad. Yeah. And this is exactly that.
I prefer that as well. What's the price, Paul?
It looks like it's going to be around the $1,200 as a starting point here in New Zealand. I haven't actually seen all of that info through, but it's, and I think it's only maybe 100-150 more for the 3G option.
So it's going to be the kind of thing that corporations buy rather than a BYOD device.
It's definitely, I think, a business sort of class device. Yeah. Where a big corporate might just outfit their staff with, they might have a few hundred staff and everyone gets one of these so they can use them out and about, and then they can dock it at their desk. And, that'll hook into their wireless keyboard and mouse and into a big, monitor like I had it plugged into my 32-inch screen here on my desk. And boom, it's working, and it was quite snappy for the few bits and pieces that I've had a chance to test it on. I mean, over the next few weeks, we'll be able to give a little bit more feedback as we spend some more time with it.
I'd be quite happy to work in a place where I can get one of them.
All right. Now, there's... there's a little counting game going on at the moment, isn't there? I guess not so much of a game. The New Zealand Census, as we record this, there'll be, I guess, quite a few people around the country that are sitting there filling out some forms on paper. But if the stats that we're hearing are accurate, there'll probably be at least as many, if not a chunk more, who are probably sitting in front of their keyboard and entering their census form digitally.
Yeah, earlier this afternoon, it was actually a tweet I saw saying that there was a million entries already done online. How many do you reckon they're going to be? There's only going to be about 3.5 million all up, I would imagine.
Well, Stats NZ, this is an interesting article on Computer World, Stats NZ saying that they expect 2 million by the end of today, and between 7 and 9 p.m. tonight, it'll be the peak. So
that and our population's what, 4.5 million, of which you've got obviously children and infants and so on who are going to have these filled out by other people.
Okay, so it's about 4 million. So we're about halfway there.
Yeah, that'll be more than Australia got in 2011, I think, when they had about 30% of their population go online and do theirs, which is really significant if you consider where we are. And it kind of shows that maybe we can do more of these things online instead of on paper and with pen.
I'd be interested to know how much money that would save doing it online as well.
Well, I guess it depends how you calculate it, because there's two sides. There'll be a lot less jobs of people having to go around and collect it, so that saves some money, but there's people that aren't unemployed. But I think this is the way things are going, and I'm sure it will get better. One thing that surprised me a little bit was, and I just filled in the dwelling form online over the weekend to get a little bit of a handle on how it worked, was there's no option to sort of save a draft. So I was partway. I thought, I'll just have a quick look at this, and we were about to head out, and then I had to say, either I leave the 17 questions that I've filled out, and the time it's going to time out after 60 minutes, and I'm going to lose everything, or else I just sit down and finish off the form, which is what I did. And the form wasn't too long, but if you're doing the main census, there's a fair bit to fill out, and there's no way for it to cation capture that. So if you get interrupted partway and come back to it half an hour or say an hour later, you're going to be starting all over again, which I thought was a bit rough.
I did that earlier, and it was about half an hour, I'd say. And I did get a call during the middle of it, and I did have to drop out, but it was still there when I got back. Actually, that reminds me of something else that I saw today. The Mighty River Power register online. You have to scroll down about 50 goddamn countries before you get to New Zealand.
To pick New Zealand.
I have to say this. I think that website has done no service to the government's plans to sell this. Firstly, they didn't announce it was going to be actually available from 10 a.m. They just said it's going to be announced today, and then people were looking for it online, very confused.
Hard to find.
And then it crashed, which is kind of understandable. There's a lot of people on it, but even after...
That's
it,
not understandable in this day and age. With
I'm going to not forgive them for that, but then...
It reminds me of the North Korean government website.
Wow, that was a long string.
Or the transit, toll collection system for the Northern Gateway, where they just didn't secure their credit card transaction. Just poorly done project. So let's
these guys, they're not in business. They don't have to make money from it. They don't care.
Yes. All right. Well, there we are. So so census, I guess, most people, that if you haven't caught this live, we don't catch it, as soon as it goes online, you probably will have filled it out. We will be interested to hear back from people, how you found that experience. Now, last week we had big announcements, which we did, which we were sort of picking in advance. From Vodafone as being the 4G LTE mobile network launch. What did you guys think? Sim, you've had a little bit of a play around with one of the new 4G handsets. You've been using the very stylish new handset from Sony, the Xperia Z.
Yep.
Have you been using a 4G SIM in that or
no,
not?
No, I'm on 2 degrees, unfortunately, which is at this point not even in the race for 4G. it might be later next year. But I was at the launch, and it was really interesting to see the types of speeds you can get. 100 megabits per second down is... theoretically what we can get on category 3 devices, as they're saying, which is what we're mostly using. But with that kind of speeds, it's just making me feel like that's better than what I have on my landline at home. I wish I had a better data plan to make it actually so I can switch over to that as my main carrier. But
I guess that highlights the difference between how long it takes to roll out fixed infrastructure and how long it takes to roll out mobile infrastructure, we know that to roll out ultra fast broadband, it's the better part of 10 years to do that project. Mobile, we'll do some software upgrades, some other bits and pieces behind the scenes, and it's not quite boom, but it's pretty quick in the scheme of things. And Vodafone are saying by the end of the year, the majority of their network will be delivering these the ability to connect over that 4G network.
The way I look at it is this: I'll get ultra fast broadband down my road this year, but it'll be from Vodafone, not from Crown Fiber, and that's Crown Fiber could take another 6 years to arrive in my suburb. Judging by what happened with the Chorus cabinet rollout, we were the very last suburb, I think, in Auckland to be connected. We're probably going to be the last suburb to be connected to UFB. So for 6 years, my ultra-fast broadband is going to be wireless. Figure that one. And the fact is what's happening, I mean, we discussed this before on the podcast, that in places like South Korea, where people have got 4G, they're not buying fiber, or fiber is very much a sort of a specialist market.
I think what we might see is the kind of model that's taken up in places like Singapore, where fiber becomes what you use to view IPTV as opposed to your main internet source. It's what the TV networks provide you to push their content to you, as opposed to something you use to do your work or business, which might move on to this mobile.
I think where you've got multiple users, it's essential to have that type of bandwidth, and also the download caps that are obviously on mobile from talking to Vodafone and Telecom, and 2 degrees. I haven't really had any strong indications that we're going to see a massive uptick in terms of the size of the data caps
that we have.
Because there's a limited bandwidth available.
Yeah, I'm not so sure about that, because I was talking to a friend of mine who was here from the UK, who was asking me about the data caps on mobile, and I said, "Well, what are you getting?" He said, "I don't know. I think it's unlimited. I've never had to worry about how much data I download." And I said, "What, you mean movies and stuff?" He said, "Yeah, I can download movies, multiple movies, on my phone network for no extra cost." I don't know whether it actually is uncapped, but you know,
most of them seem to have these fair use type policies, yeah, is what we're seeing. You know, I haven't heard of, you know, 50 gig or 500 gig data caps on.
But the thing is that once the competition kicks in, once the third carrier has 4G, then what are they going to compete on? They can compete on service levels and data caps.
Yeah,
I think that's something to look forward to.
Yeah, that's a good day for all of us. Unfortunately, the CEOs of Telecom and Vodafone have said for quite some time that they aren't going to be playing at the data cap game for some time in the future. They are happy. What we have right now is sufficient, as Russell Stanners said on last
that's
week.
That's what he said last week, didn't
he? Yeah, but they haven't bought their 700 megahertz spectrum yet. And there was something posted on the Radio Standards site today about that, the spectrum auction, and I was had a quick look at it, and it looks to me like there's going to be room for a fourth player to get into that spectrum. So, you know, it could be competitive. We could see a competitive market here like you got in places like South Korea and so on.
Well, Woosh still exists as an internet provider that have used sort of mobile type spectrum to deliver service. It's, you know, it's quite feasible, you know, that they might bid for spectrum. I think they had a play with the WiMAX technology, which is one of the other sort of so-called 4G wireless tenders. Technologies, and you know, of course, that's really fallen by the wayside now, and you know, even in the US where you know, there were sort of nationwide networks of that nature, all of those things are moving to LTE. So yeah, that would be fascinating if we saw a provider that was purely focusing on data going down that direction. Now, Evernote. Do either of you use Evernote?
Yes.
Yes.
How did you feel about the?
I've just come to expect that every cloud service I use, I'll need to reset my password at least once a year just because something's going to happen.
They're going to have some security drama at some point.
Yeah, I was annoyed because I'd actually written something about it, whinging about it, and then pretty much within minutes of posting, in came the email from Evernote telling me to change my password, which was a bit slow. I mean, it was about 16 hours after the breach, and that's not good. A company like that really should have someone sitting back, you know, in the corporate HQ, Tracy Island or whatever it is, and saying, oh, hell, we've had a breach. Let's tell everyone now. That wasn't good. That was pretty poor show.
Yeah, I mean, it seems that these the services that are certainly from the sort of the consumer, you know, end of things with what are often free or lower cost type services.
Well, that's it. Isn't it
Dropbox
free?
Too. Obviously, we've seen, you know, Yahoo's extra sort of dramas recently, but it seems that at that sort of end where you've got a massive user base, they tend to be targeted quite frequently, and we do end up with issues. Sometimes the issues are from inside the organization. I think it was Dropbox that had the issue where they sort of accidentally turned off the security and anybody could access anybody's, you know, data for a while if I remember correctly on that one. And, you know, I know we've seen these issues sort of ongoing, but, you know, to me it sort of highlights that it is important if you've got really important data, to think very cautiously about where you put it. If it is something that's really important, and certainly, from a business perspective, look more to the business-oriented services that have sort of started in that direction.
Well, I was wondering about it from a different direction, which was how much do you actually have to pay to get a business class service with something like Evernote? What would be not what would they charge, but how much would it cost them to provide you with that level of service? It can't be that much. It can't be more than $20 per customer per year to.
I have to put in another perspective. I pay $5 a month on Evernote because I need more notebooks than the average person. Mm. And up until that breach, I've had excellent service. I've had great uptime. I've never had any real problems with the service. So I'm wondering, do we sometimes see this one breach and think, oh, the service is useless, we have to attack it, as opposed to what happened to that 6 years beforehand?
Yeah.
Where did all that pedigree go in that one breach? And maybe that's a part of the communications thing, is they need to be better at telling us things have happened so we remember, well, we had a good run, let's just fix it now and move on.
And I mean, there are always going to be, you know, issues with technology, or maybe one day in the you know, distant millennia, there, you know, everything will be absolutely perfect. But no, it is a good point. But I think it's, you know, it's also important to look at, you know, a product has been designed for, say, the mass market, as opposed to something that's been designed around, you know, security and auditing and all these other sort of layers that, you know, that you know, business and government type customers will, you know, will require. And, you know, hence why we've still got so many, you know, we look in the US at BlackBerry. It's still got a very, very strong market share. You know, one reason, you know, being how heavily it's adopted by government from that security perspective, that they're very, very keen to be as secure as possible. So that's always a, you know, I guess a driver in particular spaces.
Yeah, yeah. I think Sim's got a good point there, is that one breach in 6 or 7 years, and it's not a fatal breach. I don't think any data was actually stolen, was it?
Well, it's kind of hard to know.
Yeah, they don't tell you that, so they tell you things like, well, you should reset your password. And
you've got to presume that they're being as straight up as they can be. I think they'd get in a lot of trouble if they were, you know, deliberately dishonest. But, you know, from their perspective, they can't see any sign of it. But yeah, we look back on the dramas that I guess Sony had around PlayStation, you know, network. I guess there's a whole range of levels that organizations can focus on security, and you know, in some cases, but and it seems to be more those consumer oriented sort of you know, products. It is. There can be more holes than something that's designed with security as kind of a focus, core focus from the get-go.
What's the worst thing that can happen if your Evernote account is hacked? I mean, in my case, I've just got business stuff that I keep there.
And I think it's probably fine for a sort of 1-2 man band, those sorts of things where you're doing something. But if you're a big, you know, organization that's got, you know, other people's data within your, you know, your files and so on, yeah, you potentially can get into hot water. There might be information about, you know, share market launches and, you know, other things. Yeah. You know, I mean, it depends what sort of business you're in, what sort of confidential, you know, data that you would carry. But I think most businesses would like to know that what's theirs is theirs and is, you know, kept away from prying eyes. But there's also the other situation, which I think we saw in Australia some weeks back, is you know, business networks that have been left and have not been secured properly. And I think it was a medical center of some form that their network was breached and it was taken over by criminals that basically said, look, you need to pay us out all this money, otherwise you cannot have your data back. And they'd had an issue with their backup. Maybe these guys had been in their network for a period and made sure that backups weren't running. But you know, it was such that they needed the data that was on their system, and these guys had got in and basically encrypted their own data and weren't going to allow them back in unless they fronted up with hundreds of thousands of dollars.
That's right. But there's
risks
story.
From all directions.
Well, there's another story about exactly the same criminal gang who tried it on with another bunch in Australia, and apparently there's this old systems op type guy who'd been around. You know, he's probably older than me. Been around forever, and he insisted on backing everything up to tape every night. And of course, when they
which is
what should be done. But people thought he was a bit crazy, you know, this old guy backing up to tape, what a mad thing to do. And of course, they were back online within an hour and they could tell the crooks where to stuff it. So,
except the crooks probably would still be able to get in using the same method they got in beforehand, unless they worked out how to lock, you know, how to lock it down, which I'm sure they did.
I think you'd be locking it down at that point, yeah.
But it's best not to get into that position in the first place, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, so an interesting one there. Now, Apple and Samsung, of course, there was a huge amount of coverage around, you know, the litigation between these two last year, and Apple being very triumphant with their award of, you know, over $1 billion US dollars against Samsung. But apparently this has been chopped back. At this stage, to around 600 million, and the rest of it sort of sitting in dispute for review by the judge.
Well, let's put this into perspective. What kind of money do these two companies make each year? You know, that's probably a few days' income. It's not, you know, it's $1 billion here, $1 billion there, you know, Samsung and Apple we're talking about. It's not, I mean, it sounds, it's a huge amount of money, but it's, to these people, it's not that huge. And, you know, there's a bit of this sort of corporate macho thing going on, that they're fighting these battles as well. It does seem, you know, that both of them could just choose to walk away from this one.
Yeah, I mean, does it mean anything that Apple won this case? And now, what does it mean that that this is being slashed back by the judge?
Now they have
the
rights to
judge.
All rounded rectangles. Yeah. I really don't think it means much more than they've got one thing in the precedence box that they'll use in the next court battle. It's going to be one of those ongoing war of attrition type situations where they're just going to fight each other through this proxy legal battle.
Are we going to get to a point where they sign an agreement like Apple and Microsoft did, you know, way back when, and, you know, Apple were coming after Microsoft saying you can't make an operating system controlled
personal.
With a mouse and so on. And
it feels does. Personal. It feels more than just a legal. It feels like Steve Jobs, before he left, said, look, I don't like these guys. Make sure they don't survive. Let's do everything we can. It just feels that way to me.
Yeah, well, I was going to say, I think you're right, but I think something else. Just because you're innovative and very, very successful doesn't stop you being a patent troll.
No. Good point, Bill. Very good point. Anyone can be a patent troll.
Yeah, yeah.
You just need some patents, and most of the big players have got plenty of them. All right, now, Office 365 from Microsoft. Now, of course, this is their, traditionally been their online, suite of services, and they've expanded it out earlier this year with a consumer version of Office that they now label Office 365 that under a subscription, situation. So really, I guess Office 365 refers to Microsoft's Office subscription services, which can include both the Office application and can include those server pieces that, you know, businesses traditionally, you know, installed on their premises, Exchange Server, SharePoint, Link. But it's getting a bit confusing, isn't it?
Well, I was going to say there's a branding issue here, isn't there? There's some kind of branding issue. Because you're quite right. I thought that we had the prices for Office 365, and then along came this story about the prices for Office 365. What, it would have been called the Business Edition, the Small Business Edition, whatever. You know, the different SKUs that Microsoft always talks about.
The stock code units.
Yeah, the stock code units, yeah. And, you know, talk about artificially breaking the market up into sectors and charging them differently and confusing the hell out of everyone.
Well, they've always had, I think they've always, to be fair, they've always had a varying levels of product at the business end. And there are really only a small number of options for the, at the consumer end of things, but there are still a range of business options, and in fact, with this release, they've added in some offerings. You know, before we had the enterprise option and the enterprise options and the small business options. Now we've got we've got some mid-sized sort of points
this,
as well.
This is the SharePoint version, really, isn't it?
When you buy Office 365, you know, in the past it's been a subscription to access a cloud or virtualized hosted environment of Microsoft Exchange Server, which is their email product, which has been wildly successful, I guess, over the last 10 to 15 years. SharePoint, which has certainly grown into a big business for them, over the last few years as well. And then Link, which is growing as a tool for video conferencing and calling.
It's like a PBX replacement.
And replacing a whole phone system in a business environment. So originally when you would sign up to Office 365, you were getting those elements, and then the other part you were able to get was a subscription to Microsoft Office itself, which was a change from the old school way of sort of, buying Microsoft Office in a license agreement or as a package product. So we're still seeing that as Office 365, but now we've got we've got extended options, and we've got that ability for a consumer to go and buy a so-called Office 365, which is really just a subscription. In most regards, a subscription to Microsoft Office, but they are bundling in 20 gigs worth of SkyDrive storage with that, and an hour's worth of calling on Skype. So they're doing some smart stuff with throwing in some sort of value adds
there. I think they've got that side of the equation right, but I've heard a lot of squealing from businesses about the price of the business version of 365. Have you been hearing that at all?
No, I haven't. I mean, it's certainly, I think the part of the reason why it seems to be growing is that it tends to be cheaper than running those servers and so on in-house for a business. So there seems to be quite a swing towards it away from running the traditional services. I mean, it's at a premium price point compared to Google Apps, but because most businesses are already running Microsoft systems, their staff know how to use them. The natural, swing for those, certainly for larger businesses, is to stay on the same platform. A little bit different with startups and so on, who have really only had the choice in the past of Google Apps as an option until 365 came along.
Well, I've been looking at it. I've been looking at it from a very personal point of view, and I came to the conclusion in the week that I'm probably going to be buying the personal edition of 365, but I don't really need it. I could probably get by with the web apps, which are free. But
you did an interesting blog post about this.
I think I could get by, but I just don't. I mean, apart from anything else, it's my sort of professional curiosity about what's going on and needing to stay in touch with what business is doing as opposed to going out on a limb. But the other thing is I don't know, it's Microsoft's pricing structure is really quite strange, and I think it's the gateway drug syndrome. You know, they get people hooked on the free stuff, and we've got this
bump in a few more features for the paid options.
A bit harder over here, but you know, you can take it. And
I think that's a sort of a common model, isn't it? These days, is the freemium model, where we're going to give you a bunch of stuff for free. We see something similar, with Google and their app offerings. There's a bunch of stuff that you can get for free, but once you get to a certain point, then you need to start paying some money.
Yeah. Well, I figured that I've got there's three people in my house who need Office, so the 365 home package is a really good price. It's about $50 each, I think $55 each. That's great.
Mm. So what is it,
$165, I think.
$165 a year?
Yeah, that kind of price, yeah.
Yeah, for your Office subscription. You have to pay it each year, but you can install on up to five devices, right?
Yeah, it's a good deal. Mm. The business one, it's a good deal because you don't need servers. You don't need to have the broom cupboard full of cranky old Dells and things, danger of failing, people having to come in on the weekend to fix it all and so on. It's great from that point of view.
Still a transition though. I think, most businesses that have got servers today, can't necessarily just turn everything off and move to 365 because there are functions and, capabilities they need to run in-house. What we've seen Gorilla is that, for newer and smaller businesses, we might be able to go, entirely cloud-based, but for other businesses there is usually a transition. And if we look at it over the longer term with ultra fast broadband and much better connections to the internet, then the requirement to have infrastructure in-house will I'm sure disappear entirely in most cases. And there are obviously ways to do that today. Sometimes it costs a little bit more to host those servers outside your premises, or a lot more depending on your capabilities and storage and those sorts of things. But it is very much moving away from having a lot of infrastructure.
Except as we talked about with Evernote, I would still have some form of local backup. Yeah, I know it's old fashioned. Yeah, I know I'm a bit boring saying it, but until these security tied down, I'd still have some form of local backup.
Yeah, and I mean, one of the things we often see in small businesses is backing up individual machines now, and there's some really good ways to do that across the network with something like a small business server, from Microsoft or the Windows Server Essentials they've got today. So some of those tools, they still play their part for having hardware and infrastructure on site.
Are you still with Office, Sim?
Yeah, I actually use Office 365 for work. We have an enterprise account, I think. Mm. Again, nomenclature, I'm completely screwed up because I have no idea what branding is right now. It works well enough for what we need to do. And my thinking always is never underestimate the power of the receptionist, because she's the one that has to use this office for since you know they started working. They're the ones that are going to control what your company ends up using, because it's the average user that's been using this for so long that just won't be able to switch off completely to something like Google Apps.
Yeah. What do you think they should call the business edition then? Office 375? Office 465?
Or just make it easier for me to figure out in a little, you know, one of those side-by-side comparison bars. Yeah.
It's just Office.
Yeah.
All right. So 365. It's out in the market now. Now, one of the probably the frustration points that we've heard, and I guess this is sort of reflects back on Microsoft's legacy of producing new software versions each year, and they're sort of the opposite to Google. Google. Everything was sort of born of the cloud, as it were. Their offerings have been cloud based from the get go. That they don't have a fat app that you can a full blown app that you can install locally, and they just keep doing updates as they go, which probably has some annoyances to it if something changes that you don't like and it just sort of happens, or if something goes wrong. But in general, I think that's worked pretty well for them. But Microsoft, have still got Exchange, for instance, as one of their Office 365 components, as something that can be installed on your premises, and you can have that mixed environment between what's installed, your Office plus something on the cloud as well. But the frustration that we've been hearing is people that are on Office 365, they've been early adopters. They got it ahead of this new wave of products, and the new waves come out, and they're told, "Yes, you're getting the new version this year." Hold on, it just came out last week. I would like it now. Well, if you sign up for a brand new account, you can have it right now.
So the accounts don't roll over.
So the accounts will roll over to the new version, but because of the nature of how the software is architected and so on, I guess Microsoft are taking a cautious approach, and it's going to take them probably more than weeks. It's going to take them some months to get people onto the new versions. Now, probably in the future when we go to the next wave, that won't be an issue. And they've already been doing quarterly updates on Office 365 in the previous iterations. But to make this big leap to all the new versions of this big suite, it's actually going to take them some months to do, which I can understand some some businesses being quite frustrated that
they're being left early behind. Adopter right? Next time, yeah. That's what it's going
to
be.
You sort of wait for the new version to come out, and then you buy
3.1.
Yeah. So, I think that's something that they will fix over time. But
hang on a minute, Paul. So they're saying we can't change all our servers at once. However, if you pay us money, we can.
So what you could do, for instance, is to say sign up for a brand new account, transfer all your stuff off your old one. You'd be running the new stuff right now today. But if you're an existing customer, you will have to wait until they tell you, "Hey, we're going to be bumping you up to the new version."
Yeah, that's not the dream you're sold with cloud computing, is it?
No. So a little bit of a chink there in Microsoft's armor. We'll keep watching this one, and I hope we'll be hearing a story that improves next time around. Now, TVNZ. They released in the last week or so their new on-demand app for iOS. So that works on iPhone and the iPad. Have either of you guys had a little bit of a look? I've been playing around on both the iPad and the iPhone.
Quite a bit for StopPress. I've even talked to the guys who are behind the app, and it's very interesting just the work that's gone on behind the scenes. It's built in three parts. Like TVNZ has the assets, then their agency built the layout, and then this company in the US built the actual player.
Oh, okay.
Because the iPad needs a special, iOS needs a special DRM system in order for them to buy content.
To secure the video. So, because I guess you've got all of these studios that are making the TV programs and the movies and so on, and they've got to be really confident if they're going to allow TVNZ to distribute these digitally. They don't want TVNZ to distribute it and then suddenly everyone downloads it and republishes
that's
it back onto the internet.
It's regionally locked to New Zealand. You can't view it outside. I did notice something else that a Twitterer, I think it's Chris Bain, pointed out, which is you can't connected through AirPlay to your TV or through any type of HDMI. It does have a little note in the error message that says, maybe in the future we'll be able to do this. But that's kind of annoying for people who want to use this as their as a remote for their Apple TV Media Center setup.
Yeah, that's exactly what I'd want to do with it.
Yeah, but no, I think it's still useful, and that is the reason that we have seen that with this and with others is really very much around, you know, managing that content and making sure that it doesn't get stolen. Although, you know, as we see, you know, every major movie and TV program ends up as a digital download, you know, fairly quickly anyway. But this, you know, they want to stop their digital stream being used in this manner at as many points as possible.
TVNZ does have an obligation to the content providers to at least put up a show that they are fighting piracy and things like that. So I guess they have a reason for this. It does make the barrier to entry, or at least the usefulness to a lot of people, less significant and annoys people more than anything. But I can understand where they're coming from. The app itself is great. I've been using it quite frequently. I don't actually like TVNZ content very much, but you know, if their app is good, I'm just going to be more likely to use it.
Yeah, well, I was testing it out, the on demand actually from my laptop over Telecom's sort of 4G trial network, and yeah, found that was working quite well. And yeah, then jumped to it on the iPad and the iPhone, played on it as well, and seems to work very nicely. Thank you very much.
And for the Android fans, there is an app in the works and should be out soon, according to the people who developed it. But I think it's going to be limited to Samsung tablets only.
There are some of those sort of exclusive agreements, and I think the app's available on Samsung smart TVs at the moment. I think that was part of an exclusive, you know, arrangement as well. Those tend to work as a sort of, you know, Samsung, someone, maybe they might contribute to the cost of development or something, and in return they'll get an exclusivity for, say, 3 months or 6 months, whatever the period is, and then it will become available more broadly is what I would pick anyway. I don't think that's a long-term play from TVNZ to, you know, only be on one manufacturer's device.
I was going to say it's good for Samsung, but it's not good for Android at all.
Yeah, but these things will, you know, as I say, they'll end up on more platforms. Now, the other thing was, I talked about trying it out on the laptop with Telecom's 4G, which, of course, I was limited to their test area. But with Vodafone, of course, having launched their 4G network, I was able to try that out on the iPhone and, you know, being outside of Wi-Fi coverage and over the 4G, and that worked flawlessly as well. So yeah, I'm looking forward to Vodafone broadening out that 4G LTE coverage. I think it's about 30% of Auckland at the moment, and not you know, much else anywhere else around the country. But that's gonna come throughout the year, right? So I think Christchurch is up next, and then Wellington sort of August, September. May for Christchurch, isn't it?
I have to defend Vodafone here. Some people have been complaining on Twitter and forums saying, obviously, they're going to go with Auckland. They're not thinking about the rest of the country. I think it's great that they're even going to Christchurch in May and then rolling out to Wellington quite soon afterwards in the year. To me, it seems like they're doing the right thing here, and they're getting 30% of Auckland first. Then they're going to the second biggest city in the country, and then they're going to Wellington. It seems like the right way to go about it.
Well, yeah, except I think they've raced it out early in Auckland. Probably a bit undercooked in terms of the network build. Obviously, for competitive reasons, they needed to be first. They probably got wind that there was an announcement from the competitor coming. Because, you know, if you actually step back and think about it, why would you roll a network out to 30% of a city to about, you know, 500,000 people? It's a bit undercooked.
You could say the same of Telecom rolling out a trial of 4G on network frequencies that, you know, may never end up actually being used in the real world. I mean, there's always a marketing aspect to these things, getting that attention, being first. But I'm pretty happy about having 4G available
I'm not complaining about
right
it being
now,
here.
So no complaints. Actually, one of the other bits that was around the 4G announcement was we got to have a play with some new handsets. Now, you've got the Sony Xperia Z there, which we mentioned before, but there was also the HTC One, which got announced a few weeks ago. We didn't actually end up having much of a chance or any chance to discuss it on the podcast the week that it was announced, but we got to have hands on with that as well. Really stunning handset. What did you think of it, Sim?
I didn't actually get to play with the One, unfortunately.
Oh, I'm sorry to hear that.
Yeah, I did see it, and it looked good.
It kind of looks like some sort of iPhone crossover, very sort of iPhone-like, but really nice, solid build, but an iPhone sort of esque styling to it. And I think what we've got here from Sony and from HTC are two really strong, handset releases. Nice. Good size screens, but that full high definition, a feature set that I think with the Galaxy S4 launch from Samsung, they're going to have to deliver a really, really strong product to sort of stand out head and shoulders above or even to match these, because they're both really cool.
Well, I think we're not looking at the elephant in the room here, which is that the iPhone is really falling behind the pack. I read a piece in the Australian Financial Review this morning, which was saying that, looking at the specifications, what you get and so on for your money, that the iPhone is probably the ninth best phone on the market in Australia at the moment.
Has it ever been number one?
Well,
really? Apart from when it first...
It was for years, but probably for the last couple of years, it's been falling behind, but it's been falling further and further behind. And... the thing is Apple's going to need to get into a faster upgrade cycle, I think, if they're going to stay with these Android people. The Android market seems to be turning over about once every 8 or 9 months. So the once a year launch from Apple just isn't cutting anymore.
Yeah, I mean, I guess Apple are playing a slightly different, different game. And in the Android, space, you got a whole lot of, there is a whole lot of competition. And once... once a new screen becomes technically possible and affordable, we're seeing everyone put these full high definition. Well, we're guessing anyway that every manufacturer that can is going to end up with a full high definition screen in a smartphone, which is in many ways it's madness when you think about it. That's the same definition we see on a massive 60 inch TV, and you've got that on the phone that you carry. But I'm reasonably happy with that resolution. No complaints. I don't know if there's really much further we can go in that space. But yeah, we've got Sony that have gone in with the waterproof thing with the with the Xperia Z, and also we got to see last week some of the Tablet Z, which we had talked about briefly, but we got to have a hands on with one of the first units in the country. And that is a really nice tablet too, right? That's the same thing. You got
brilliant,
gorgeous tablet. Waterproof. This is a nice
piece
of kit.
The OS was a bit buggy, but it was explained away. It was a developer build, but it was such a great little tablet. And my thing is, I want to be able to be portable. I don't need the power so much as I need good portability and a good device. So a waterproof tablet that's thin and light and looks good is perfect for me. I don't know why I have an iPad.
You need a waterproof one in Auckland anyway.
Yeah, well, that's true. Well, I mean, the promo video was pretty funny. The guy's sort of showing it off, and then they sort of take the camera back or whatever, and he slides back in the bath, and the tablet sort of half under, half in the water and so on. But actually, it makes sense to have devices that can be dropped, devices that can get a little bit wet without being stuffed and so on. These are good innovations.
My review for the Xperia Z, which is coming out in Ideolog tomorrow, has me in the shower with my phone. It's just great. I don't know why I would ever actually need to be in the shower with the phone, but I like knowing that I can be in the shower with the phone. No? Yeah.
I think for certain types of models, that could be a business.
Now, a couple of other bits of news over the last few days. We've had seller.co.nz, which I guess has been the closest we've ever seen to any form of competitor to Trade Me. They're basically shutting that down as an auction site. They're taking what was there and reutilizing it within within the business.
What was classifieds, I suppose. Yeah,
yeah, they're starting off with motoring and property inside of NZ Herald and the other papers as a classified system.
When did you last go to seller?
When I checked for the story. And that's only time I ever go there.
They talk about it having somewhere between 1% and 3% of the, you know, the auction market. So
it's probably about right. Yeah.
You know, very, very little. And the other story that that came through in regards to media, and we were talking about TV before, Sky TV, their big shareholder in News Limited, has bailed and sold out, 43% shareholding that they...
43.675, yeah.
Okay, there we go. Sim's got the real numbers.
They confirmed it this morning, and Sky's back on for trades. They halted the trades yesterday. So that's about $815 million in News Limited's coffers. So
yeah,
good stuff for them.
Well, I think News are getting out of TV in a number of markets as well, aren't they?
Yeah, they're trying to separate their publishing arm and their TV arms.
They're probably just realizing that the longer term future of some of those things won't be as bright as what it is now. You'd have to think with the direction things are going, there's not going to be as much profit to be made as we move to a world where media is consumed in different ways.
What I was wondering about, you may know this, Sim, is what happens to the content deals that Sky have got with News?
I think they've got service agreements through Fox and things like that overseas. I was asking the question whether it would affect that their ability to source that content. They're adamant it won't, which makes me think that it will, obviously.
And I'm thinking things like Super 15 and or Super... whatever it is now, rugby and sports coverage and so on, which Murdoch's got a lot of that tied up.
The thing is, though, Sky is the monopoly content, major content provider here. Money is money. The content people, if they want in New Zealand right now, have Sky and then to a lesser extent the TV network. So I don't think it'll be a huge
probably
change.
Probably not an immediate change there. And now the last thing we had on the list, Bill, was something you came across from IDC. Now this is sort of the crossover between business and consumer technology.
Yeah.
There were some interesting observations that IDC had made in Australia.
There was a survey of BYOD users in Australia.
So these are the people that support being able to bring personal devices into their business environments, which is becoming more and more common.
It is, and basically they're saying that it's now the mainstream thing to do. It's about 60% of Australian businesses now have some form of BYOD going on. Whether it's formal or not is another matter. But the two things came out. The obvious thing about security is a problem. Well, we've all heard that before. It's not that the technology is insecure, it's that the people are insecure. We know that. That's a given. The interesting thing that for me was that when asked which device people would choose if they had their, they could choose their own devices, their favourite was BlackBerry.
So who are they asking? Are they asking the CIO or are they asking the individual?
It's business executives, but
staff. What sort of level are these people at?
It doesn't make that clear, but you get the impression they're business executives. But BlackBerry,
that's fascinating. And another story there, Sim?
Yeah, I just seen this on the NBR right now. We haven't got full details here, but it says that TradeMe has sold the daily deals site TreatMe in a management buyout. That's interesting.
Well, I guess from TradeMe's perspective, it was actually a very small property for them. And, they're the sort of entity that I guess wants to have big things that can make mega profits. And my pick is it just wasn't really
a distraction.
It was a bit too much of a distraction. They weren't making a big enough return on it. So
and daily deals, the whole idea of daily deals has completely slowed down. Yeah. And even in the US with Groupon, it's not doing it nearly as well as when it started. And
the
it's
market's in retreat big time. Yeah,
yeah. So it makes sense for TradeMe to divest off this what we're calling distraction here.
Yeah,
but for a couple of two or three blokes in a small office somewhere. It's quite a nice little business.
It might work well. Yeah. All right. Well, that wraps us up for this week. Thank you, everyone, for listening in. We have something else special coming through in the next little while, but that we'll leave it at that. That's all we're saying. Now, Sim, we can catch you online on Twitter.
Yep, that's at Simantics, S-I-M-antics, or you can see my writing at stoppress.co.nz or idealog.co.nz, and I'll have the Sony Xperia Z review on in Idealog tomorrow.
Oh, very cool. And Bill?
BillBennett.co.nz, and I'm BillBennettNZ on Twitter.
Excellent.
And I should probably mention that we've started talking a bit on Google Plus recently.
Oh, that's true. We've just set up a little. There's a new communities feature within Google Plus. So we've set up a NZ Tech community. So
come and join us.
Anyone that wants to have a chit chat with Bill and me and Sim and anyone else. We're just trying it out to see to see whether it's a useful environment for having a community. Of course. Most of these sort of online things that are done there could probably just as easily be done on Geekzone, which has a huge base and a lot more to it. But we thought it'd be fun just to have a bit of an experiment. So if anyone else is on Google Plus, you can certainly feel free to add us and NZ Tech Podcast, and also to jump in and have a look at that NZ Tech. Sort of discussion group, isn't it?
Yeah. It's, like I say, it's pretty experimental now, but Google Plus seems to be getting some kind of momentum going. But it tends to be within certain interest groups.
Well, the scale of Google sort of guaranteed that people are going to look, and I guess there'll be certain areas where they're going to get a bit more traction than others. So, we'll see where that goes. You can track me down, of course, as well online. Paul Spain is my Twitter handle. And my blogging is at techjungle.com primarily. I'm also on paulspain.com. And you can find us for the podcast at nztechpodcast.com and also NZ Tech Podcast on Facebook and Twitter and Google. So that's it. Thanks, everyone. See ya.
Bye.